First the hotel cook, then some Swiss shopkeepers, then another and another, until now the hotel was no longer operating, and no shops were open at all. The shoemakers had vanished. The Germans who repaired things were no longer to be found. The llaneros had driven the large herds south, where they would have better winter feed, they said, and then they had vanished. Brown Limper had taken it up with Sniff. Did this have anything to do with the Brigantes? Even Turl put the question to him. But Sniff swore up and down he and his men had behaved. The academy was still there and operating. There seemed to be a vast number of pilot trainees and a vaster number of machine operators. But they stayed down at the academy, and all one saw was an occasional plane doing practice flights. All his office radios and teleprinters were gone. They broke down and had to be away to be repaired, and then they never came back. But never mind. Brown Limper couldn't operate them anyway, and when this new banknote was making a world of dent to his morale, he decided he would not pay the pilots in it. He'd get even with them. People would be hanging him, Brown Limper, on their walls now. On sudden impulse, he decided he had better mend his political fences with his own tribe, and show them this bill, of course. He called Lars and General Sniff, and they got into a mine passenger plane Lars kept in the parking lot, and took off for the new village he had put his people in. Brown Limper was still admiring one of the banknotes he held in his hand. The thought of showing it off to the village people warmed him. He did not even mind the harrowing way that Lars flew. Narrowly missing snow-covered peaks not even on their route, Lars settled near the old mining town. But it all seemed deserted. Not a single plume of smoke rose from a fire. Not even the smell of it remained. Carrying a Thompson, Sniff scouted the place. Empty. Not even a trace of belongings. Nothing. Brown Limper searched, looking for a clue, dragging his club foot through the smooth snow from building to building. Finally, he found where they must have had a meeting. There were some torn scraps of paper lying about, and then, under a table where it might have fallen off a pile of papers unnoticed, he found a letter. It was from Tom Smiley Townsend. Brown Limper looked at it and went into an immediate rage. Not at what it said, but at Tom Smiley's having the effrontery to know how to write. What arrogance! But then he saw it was not really written, it was printed, and rather crudely at that. Even the signature was printed. So he decided to be tolerant and read it. The letter went on and on about how nice some area known as Tashkent was. Big mountains, endless plains of wild wheat, lots of sheep, and a mild winter climate. And how he had gotten married to some Watton. Disgraceful. No blood purity there. Brown Limper threw the letter down. Well, maybe the village people had gone back to their old home. They had not wanted to move. But he was surprised that the Indians and the people from the Sierra Nevadas and the other British Columbian fellow had not remained here, for they hadn't cared for the old village. Too cold and too heavy a prospect of starving every winter. They flew to the old village. Lars had trouble setting down and almost landed in the middle of one of those uranium circles. When he could let go of his grip on the seat, Brown Limper looked around. No smoke here either. Brown Limper poked into some of the houses. When they had moved at such short notice, people had had to leave most of their personal possessions behind, and Brown Limper thought they must still be there. But no. Every house was empty. Not ransacked, the way Brigantes left places. Just neatly empty. With a bit of fear, because it had been booby-trapped, he approached the old Tyler house. It was still standing. Maybe the booby-traps hadn't gone off. Then he saw that some of the roof was bulged, and he went around to the other side to where the front door had been. The door had been blown off. Lars and Sniff were poking at something in the snow. It was the remains of two Brigantes. What hadn't been burned had been torn apart by wolves. It was obvious they had tripped the booby traps, and quite a while ago. General Sniff poked at the scraps of money, skin, and bones with the muzzle of the submachine gun.
Moose had come up here
Browling for loot, said Sniff. Waste of good meat. Brown Limper wanted to be alone. He dragged his foot up the slope to the place they once had buried people. He turned at the top and gazed down at the empty village, falling apart and now abandoned forever. Something had been nagging at him, and now it hit him. He was a tribal leader without a tribe. From 5 tribes, he had descended to 1, the Brigantes, and they were not native to America. Numbly, he realized he had better keep this awfully quiet. It undermined his whole position. Something caught his eye. A monument? A small stone shaft sticking up out of the ground. He moved around it. It had an inscription. Timothy Brave Tyler, a good father, erected in respectful memory by his loving son, J.G.T. Brown Limper screamed. He tried to kick the monument down. It was too firmly planted, and he only bruised his foot. He stood and screamed, tearing the echoes of the valley apart. Then he stopped. It was all Johnny Good Boy Tyler's fault. Everything that had befallen Brown Limper all his life was totally and wholly Tyler's fault. So Tyler would come again, would he? Turl might have his plans, and they might be all right. But Brown Limper was going to make very, very sure. If Tyler ever hit that firing platform again, he was a dead man. Brown Limper went down to the waiting plane. He said to Lars and Smith, they mustn't know what he really intended,
"For our mutual protection, I think you should teach me how to use a Thompson submachine gun."
They agreed it would be wise. Turl had said time and again you didn't dare shoot off a gun during a transshipment. But who cared about that? 2 guns. He would use 2 guns. Brown Limper planned how he would do it all the way back to Denver. 3. The small gray man sat watching the strange antics of a terrestrial craft several miles above his orbit. The combined force had learned over a month ago to leave such a craft alone. Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snowell, already in disgrace over trying to sneak a kidnap and cut them out of the potential loot, had charged his Vulcor-class cruiser, guns blazing, at a ship doing exactly what this one was doing. The strange craft had sidestepped neatly. There reportedly had been a series of clangs against the cruiser's hull. Snowell had pulled up, mystified as to what the clangs betokened. He had sent crewmen out on lines to inspect his hull, and they had been horrified to discover they had about 20 limpet mines on it, held solidly by magnetism to the hull. The terrestrial craft had apparently mined the orbit they used. Snowell had been further embarrassed to discover that the mines did not explode. They had atmosphere pressure fuses, which meant that if he brought the Vulcor-class cruiser within 100,000 feet of the planet's surface, the air pressure would explode them there. Every commander had hastily examined his whole ship to see if he had picked any up. They hadn't, but it meant to them that if you chased that terrestrial ship, it threw a cloud of mines in your path. Very unnerving. So they left it alone. The ship had a huge door in the side and a lot of cranes. The small gray man was no miner or military expert, but the ship was obviously collecting space debris. It wasn't using its cranes, so it must have a big magnet inside that door. Apparently, it would spot something on its screen. There were a lot of odd bits in orbit just now, as a large, strange comet had entered the system lately, evidently from some other system, and bits of it were floating around and occasionally hitting the meteor shielding of most of these ships. Then the terrestrial would go out and pace the object. Many of them were moving as fast as 19 miles a second, and suddenly dart sideways. The apparent magnets inside that door would collect it. Rather interesting, the small gray man thought. Somewhat like a hummingbird he had once seen, darting about after insects, stopping around a flower, and then zooming off. He needed something to occupy his mind. There was no word yet. Probably wouldn't be for another couple of months. No new courier had come to him, which seemed to mean that the one had not been found elsewhere. These were very troubled times. His indigestion had begun to act up again. About ago, he had gone down to see the old woman. He had run out of pep. She had been glad to see him, and so had the... She had used the Vaux Quarter to start up some trade with the Swedes, oats and some butter, and she was rolling in money. Lex credits. Enough to buy an acre of ground or another cow. And she had been busy evenings. Colder, and it must be an awful lot colder up there in the sky. And she had knitted him a nice gray sweater. The small gray man had the sweater on now. It was quite soft and warm. He touched it and felt a little sad. He had told those military men that it was politically inadvisable to try to operate in the highlands of Scotland, and he thought they had listened. But just a week ago he had gone down to get some more peppermint, and the old woman was gone. The house was closed up. The dog was gone. The cow was gone. There seemed to be no sign of violence, but then you never knew with these military men. They could be very sneaky and thorough at times. He had dug up a few sprigs of mint from under the snow, but was quite troubled. Anything like sentiment was a foreign thing to him. But he had felt troubled nonetheless. These military men, they were so obsessed with finally smashing up this planet that they were quite restless when asked to wait for his courier. They got such silly ideas. They had noted that every plane and every installation down there now seemed to have a little creature in an orange-yellow robe. They couldn't understand the messages now being sent on the planet's radios. They had tried language machines, and none worked. Then they tried all their coding and scrambling machines, and none worked. All the messages seemed to begin and end with, Om Mani Padme Om, like a sort of chant. That place in southern Africa near the Big Dam, the one the terrestrials had used to lure in and trap two raiding parties, was being all cleared out, and it gave them their first clue. A pagoda-like structure, several in fact, were being erected. They found in some old reference texts that the design was a religious temple. So the military men had agreed that the planet had now experienced a new political upheaval. Some religious zealots had taken over. Religions were very dangerous. They inflamed people. Any sensible government and its military should stamp them out. But they were not concerned with politics and religion just now. They would wait. The small gray man turned his attention from the terrestrial craft to the combined force. It had increased in number now to 13. New arrivals. Other races. They had brought the news that there was a 100 million credit prize offered now to the ship or ships that discovered the one. Thus, they were more eager to raid and collect evidence than they were to gut the planet. Half-Captain Rogo-Dieter Snowell had become quite incensed with this place, obsessed with it, in fact. But his military sense was telling him that he was outnumbered by the rest of the combined force, and he had left a couple of weeks ago to return to his planet and bring up additional war vessels. It would get quite crowded in the orbits. His own captain had asked the small gray man whether he could draw off a bit from the rest. This was going to be an awful mess when these military men found out and could split the prize and then gut the planet. The small gray man had agreed. He returned to idly watching the terrestrial ship. It seemed to be finished now, possibly had a full hold. It was slowly going down into the atmosphere, making its way to the African base.